Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. Wagashig First Nation in Northern Ontario has won its injunction to stop a mining company from drilling in its territory. One lawyer says the federal government's idea to privatize reserve land is not a good one, and a possible lost world may have been found at the bottom of Lake Huron. And the review into the proposed Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline is underway, and First Nations have been opposed to the project for a number of years. You'll hear all these stories plus great tunes all coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. A Northern Ontario community is in mourning after a plane crashed, carrying some of its members. Four people died in Tuesday morning's crash in North Spirit Lake Reserve. CTV News reported there were five people aboard the small plane, including the pilot. The plane crashed near some houses on the First Nation. Then people rushed to the crash to help put out the flames with snow. And CBC reports the lone survivor, Brian Sheed, crawled from the burning plane. He had been seated in the back of the plane en route to North Spirit from Winnipeg. The cause of the crash isn't known yet, but there are reports of blizzard conditions at the time. The review into Enbridge's proposed Northern Gateway pipeline is underway. The Vancouver Sun reports the Haisla told the three-member panel an oil spill would devastate their way of life. Haisla chiefs also said they were facing a double-barreled threat because they could be facing a spill on the ocean and a spill on the Kitimat River, which empties into the Douglas Channel just north of their village. First Nation opposition to the proposed $5.5 billion project has been ongoing for more than 7 years. In 2010, a group of coastal First Nation delegates visited the Gulf of Mexico to witness the damage done by the massive British Petroleum oil spill. Gerald Amos, an executive member of the group, said seeing those effects justified their opposition.
What we did see pretty much confirmed the decision that we as coastal First Nations took to an issue ban on very large crude carriers coming on to our water.
And Takaya Blaney, a now 11-year-old Sliman girl, had been taking a stance against the oil giant for more than a year. Last summer, Takaya brought a message to the offices of Enbridge in Vancouver, but wasn't allowed in the building and didn't get a response from the oil execs.
I didn't think I was scary or anything like that, but I had Greenpeace with me in the media, and then later on we found out that they're not allowed to bring cameras in there. But I just wanted to talk to them and tell them the message. But you see, companies like this, they're not open to hearing messages that people have to say.
The review process is expected to last until spring next year. More than 4,000 people signed up as interveners, but not all seem to be legitimate. Media reports some of those on the intervener list have not even heard of the Northern Gateway proposal. In BC, the federal government is investigating an alleged large illegal sockeye catch by First Nations. The Canadian Press reports a seafood company maintains that it is caught in the middle of a dispute between the federal government and First Nations on fishing agreements. The government is looking into the catch of about 64,000 kilograms of sockeye salmon from the Johnstone Strait last summer. A spokesperson with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans wouldn't elaborate on the investigation, but said so far no charges have been laid. The investigation involves more than one First Nation and agreements between them and the federal government. The investigation came about after officials took a second look at the seafood company's paperwork. The First Nations under investigation have not been named. Shoal Lake First Nation has been sending the City of Winnipeg an $8 million bill every month since October. But the Winnipeg Free Press reports that the city doesn't have an agreement with the community. Shoal Lake has been sending the invoices after having its repeated requests to negotiate a settlement over the lake's water ignored. The city has been using the lake's water and has plans to extend water and sewer pipes. The band will be filing for an injunction later this month to stop the city from selling its water and sewer services if the city does not respond to the Shoal Lake First Nation requests. The Registered Nurses Association of Ontario says provincial and federal governments have to adequately address the prescription drug abuse plaguing Northern Ontario reserves. According to the Ottawa Citizen, Doris Grinspun, executive director of the Nurses Association, wrote to the federal health minister and her Ontario provincial counterpart. Grinspun hopes the two ministries will work together to address the impacts of the pill addiction. It's been reported that in some remote communities, about 80% of people are hooked on the painkillers, which has also resulted in more babies being born with addictions. The Anishinaabeaski Nation has been growing increasingly frustrated with the lack of real response from both levels of government. And the government has been kicking around the idea of privatizing reserve land. The House of Commons Finance Committee suggested that, presenting its pre-budget report before the Christmas break. John Rowinski is a lawyer in Ontario, and he's been against the idea since it was proposed several years ago. Essentially, he says, privatizing lands is putting the cart before the horse.
We need to ensure that the basics are in place, that First Nations communities are in a position to be self-sufficient and to shed themselves of economic dependence before we start giving more opportunities to become economically dependent. And that's essentially what this whole privatization regime is. It's intended to allow individual First Nation members to mortgage their lands.
The idea of privatizing reserve lands is not a popular one among First Nation leadership. Most compare the idea with an act in the U.S. which saw a lot of properties within the reservation lands being sold off, and that's being called the checkerboard effect. In Saskatchewan, George Gordon First Nation is suing the province and Canada for $10 billion. Media reports the band claims that it has been cheated out of potash and oil developments. In a statement, Chief Glenn Pratt said, as a people, they are sick of being cheated out of the wealth that rightly belongs to them under the treaty and Canadian and international law. Meanwhile, the federal government, aware of the lawsuit, declined to comment to media about the issue. Wagashake First Nation in Northern Ontario has won its injunction against Solid Gold Resources to stop its drilling in the territory. Kate Kempton is a lawyer for Wagashake First Nation. She says the judge's decision also included recommendations on consultation.
We further ordered that throughout that time period, the three parties, the Crown, Solid Gold, and Wagashake First Nation, need to enter into a process of bona fide and meaningful consultation and accommodation about any further or future exploration activity in the claims block. She said also that if that process does not end up, I guess from Wagashig's point of view, being productive, that Wagashig can go back to court toward the end of that 120-day period and seek an extension on the injunction.
The injunction was awarded January 3rd. And a minister in Manitoba is drawing controversy after he made comments about burial practices on some northern reserves. The minister alleged that some young suicide victims had been buried near a local landfill in Blood Vein First Nation. His comments were condemned by the community's chief, Roland Hamilton. Two First Nation political territorial organizations in Ontario have restated their positions against nuclear waste storage in their territories. The Anishinaabeaski Nation and Anishinaabeg Nation have united their voices to oppose any potential nuclear waste storage in the northern part of the province. Eight communities in northern Ontario have expressed interest in hosting a nuclear waste site. Teachers have fled the remote northern community of Pikangikum. The teachers have left because of mold in school buildings. The Anishinaabeaski Nation says an air quality test confirmed the presence of mold in seven areas. Mostly non-local teachers have left, and less than half of the school's elementary classes are running. The community is trying to find ways to keep the secondary school running. A possible lost world may have been found at the bottom of Lake Huron. Researchers have uncovered what they think could have been a corral to herd caribou for hunting and also some campsites. Lisa Sonnenberg is part of the research project, and she's with McMaster University.
They kept finding these strange stone features that, when they looked at it on a large scale, bore an uncanny resemblance to caribou drive lanes that they, you know, use in northern communities in order to corral, but guide caribou.
The evidence dates back to more than 9,000 years ago, and it was found on a ridge in Lake Huron. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Granddaddy fought the war back in 43. Shot up on the beaches in Normandy. Yeah, he fought for me. He fought for peace. He was just a boy forced to be a man. But even a man couldn't understand the things he'd seen. But he fought for peace. He seen hurt and he seen pain. He drank right to keep the ghost away. And he fought for peace. Still in the firefight back in Normandy, where he fought for peace. Lying in pain in another man's blood, thinking of the bodies left in the mud and the men they've been, where he fought for peace. He seen hurt and he seen pain. He drank right to keep the ghost away, and he fought for peace. Now I'm living in Dauphin. In the yard there's an evergreen tree. I got a job and I've got a good husband, and I remember being free.
Waukesha First Nation in Northern Ontario has won its injunction against Solid Gold Resources to stop its drilling in the territory. And Kate Kempton is the lawyer for Waukesha First Nation.
Justice Carol Brown of the Ontario Superior Court granted an injunction in a decision dated January 3rd. It's an injunction for 120 days that prevents Solid Gold from any exploratory activity on its claims block, which is in Waukesha's traditional territory. And she further ordered that throughout that time period, the three parties, the Crown, Solid Gold, and Waukesha First Nation, need to enter into a process of bona fide and meaningful consultation and accommodation about any further or future exploration activity in claims block. She said also that if that process does not end up, I guess from Waukesha's point of view, being productive, that Waukesha can go back to court toward the end of that 120-day period and seek an extension on the injunction.
All right, so what's going on in the meantime since the decision came down January 3rd and it's about a week later?
Nothing so far. We have not yet heard from the Crown or Solid Gold. We would consider that it would generally be their initiative because it's the Crown's legal duty, but it can delegate operational aspects of it to a proponent like Solid Gold, that it would be their duty generally to initiate this process, and we have not heard from either of them yet.
And in respect to that, what is Waukesha's position on that, and do they want to identify some of the heritage sites in the meantime, or what's going on?
Well, we've said all along that this area is known and has been identified to be a very high cultural heritage potential. In other words, this is This area around Lake Abitibi is the birthplace of the Abitibi people, including Waukesha First Nation. It's where their ancestors have lived for thousands and thousands of years. They lived, they worked, they had their government, their economy, their society, etc. And we know that there are cultural heritage sites, including burial sites, all throughout this area. But there's never been any on-the-ground comprehensive archaeological study to identify where precisely those sites and values and areas are. And we've said from the beginning that, you know, before work commences, some archaeological work sufficient to identify and protect anything that could be harmed from the exploration needs to occur. And I expect that Waukesha will, again, because they've been consistent in saying this all along, bring that up in a process that is initiated now.
Okay. And whose responsibility would that be?
For undertaking the work, you mean?
Right. So would that be through the province or the community?
Typically, when you're talking about a First Nations cultural heritage, in our view at least, the archaeologist has to be somebody that the First Nation trusts, because they're putting their cultural heritage in somebody's hands. They do have a couple of archaeologists that they have worked with before and do trust, and we would propose that those individuals, that those people do that, do the work. But it, you know, it should not be Waukesha that pays for the work, because it's not Waukesha seeking to do the exploratory work that could harm such cultural heritage. In our view, it should be either Solid Gold or the Crown that pays for the work.
You're listening to Bombsta. Before the Christmas break, the House of Commons Finance Committee presented its pre-budget report, and with it, they also made a recommendation that First Nations land should be privatized to reduce poverty and increase economic development opportunities. The idea is not new, and the government has been kicking it around for a few years, and it's also been the subject of a book by Tom Flanagan, who is a former advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper. John Rawinski is a lawyer in Ontario, and he's been against the idea for a few years, and he spoke with Bombsta.
An order of operations, how something like this works. You know, and as I argued, you know, a year and a half ago, or back in 2010, in the article I wrote, it needs to. We need to ensure that the basics are in place, that First Nations communities are in a position to be self-sufficient and to shed themselves of economic dependence before we start giving them more opportunities to become economically dependent. And that's essentially what this whole privatization regime is. It's intended to allow individual First Nation members to mortgage their lands.
And having said that, the government is thinking that this would be a way to get away from economic dependence.
I agree. Certainly, that's the argument that's been made. I should say I agree that that's the argument. On the other hand, I think it's actually a transfer. Economic dependence from dependency on government and on government funding and all of those things to, for lack of a better word, private lenders, whether it be big bank or other types of lenders. And, you know, as much as economic dependency on the Crown is not desirable, and I think that's a fairly universal opinion, on the other hand, there are so many opportunistic lenders out there, and we've seen it in broader society, that will be more than happy to make risky loans at extremely high interest rates for the sole purpose of, hey, if we don't get the payments, we'll get the land. And certainly where there's valuable reserve land in play, you know, that's a real risk to anyone borrowing money.
So one of the other arguments that a lot of First Nation people have pointed out is that stateside in the 1880s, they had the Dawes Act, which essentially is privatizing reservation land for Native American reserves. And what they ended up with was this checkerboard effect where, you know, right in the middle of the reserve, there's different parcels of land that have been sold off to ranchers or developers or whatever. And this is a thing that they see could happen in Canada.
certainly a possibility under this type of regime. Whereas right now on a reserve, at worst, you're going to be leasing land to non-members, non-community members, and those leases will be time limited, and so it might be for cottages or other economic benefit. In the scenario the government has proposed, or that has been pitched to the government, it could be a complete loss of that reserve land for future generations, and that raises a whole host of issues in terms of the community and how the community interacts internally. It also says that where there is limited reserve land, and most would argue not enough reserve land to suit the needs of Canada's Indigenous peoples, now you're offering an opportunity to dissipate those limited land resources.
And with the loss of reserve land, or even the privatization of some other parcels, I wonder what kind of impact that would have on treaty rights and the endless argument of revenue resource sharing if the land is going private.
And that's something that, I'll be honest, I haven't heard a lot of in this debate. And not to say that I'm sure there have been commentators who have addressed this, but it's certainly a huge red flag, which is, reserve land is protected, certainly in most of Canada, and certainly in this province, by treaty. And those rights don't run with the people so much as they run with the land. So if some of that land is, say, sold off, or even if it's mortgaged to an outside party, do those rights still apply? What are the tax implications of a sale or a mortgage of land? There's a whole bunch of issues that come up that would need to be addressed in advance. And then, the question is, are we now further dissipating treaty rights and Aboriginal rights, constitutionally and protected rights, by offering this? There's a huge question that comes from that is, can this be done without a constitutional amendment? Because Section 35 protects those Aboriginal and treaty rights. And I don't think, there's been that depth of analysis, at least in the commentary that I have seen on this issue.
Hmm. We know there's the other legal problems for land registries, and where do those go, and how does the First Nation have a role in something like that?
Provincial divide there, although I suspect, it would end up being provincial jurisdiction if the lands were really fully privatized. But again, there's a Section 91-92 law school problem in the Constitution. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of, I just think it's such a short-sighted proposal at this stage, which, and I know you're not recording anymore, but, I made the argument in 2010, and I still maintain it. I don't mean to say that it's never going to be a good idea. I just think that the other problems and the other obligations of the Crown need to be addressed before we even consider something like this.
That was John Rowinsky, a lawyer in Ontario. Blues rocker Derek Miller is going to be headlining a couple of benefit concerts this month to raise awareness for relief efforts in Attawapiskat. On the 14th, he'll be in North Bay, and on the 24th, Miller will be headlining a fundraiser in Toronto. Now here's Girls from his second CD, Dirty Looks.
Sings, I don't care, I still have to get my share. Girls, all I want is girls. Girls, all I want is girls and curls. Girls, all I want is girls. That's what I said. Every time you hit to the graveyard with your father and your holy ghost.
reports that a possible lost world may have been at the bottom of Lake Huron. Researchers with the University of Michigan first made that discovery a couple of years back, but with more help and research, more evidence dating back almost 10,000 years ago has been found. And Lisa Sonnenberg is with McMaster University, and she recently joined the team to investigate the ancient finds.
About a couple of years ago, some researchers from the University of Michigan were doing some reconnaissance at the in Lake Huron, and particularly along this ridge, which about 9,000 years ago, when water levels in Lake Huron were much lower, this ridge would have been exposed, and it actually would have been a piece of land. And while they were looking at this, they kept finding these strange stone features that, when they looked at it on a large scale, bore an uncanny resemblance to caribou drive lanes that they, you know, use in northern communities in order to corral, but guide caribou. And so they started doing more and more research, and sort of where I came into it, they realized that they needed a better idea of what the environment would have been like in this area 8,000-9,000 years ago. And that's kind of what my part of the project is to sort of look at the evidence for a paleo environment, so what this place would have looked like 8,000 years ago.
And so have you arrived at any kind of conclusions of what the people were, or what was going on there?
Not yet. One of the things we're looking at, we're certainly getting a lot more information. We've dated some organic material to 8,000 years, so we do know we're not barking up the wrong tree. We're in the right time frame. What it would have been would have been sort of a transition from what we refer to as late Paleo-Indian, early Archaic peoples. What's really interesting is that we haven't had a lot of evidence. I mean, we know people hunted caribou at this point in time because the environment would have been somewhat similar to what present-day Northern Ontario is. But in terms of what these people were actually doing, we don't know, because we know so little about that particular time period, basically because a lot of the sites are probably underwater, certainly in the Great Lakes region. But we think this particular area, there's evidence that we see places where there might have been little campsites. We see areas where there looked like there were actually hunting blinds. So we're really not sure as to the extent of this entire site. We keep finding more and more stuff to look at, but we are seeing some really interesting features, little old river channels. We're seeing like an inland lake that would have been kind of like obviously a water source that are near some of these features. So we're finding all sorts of interesting stuff. But in terms of sort of a silver bullet, you know, do we have absolute proof that humans were there? We're very close, but we don't have absolute proof as of yet. We have a lot of really, really good circumstantial evidence. So that's kind of where we're at right now.
And I know that, I'm certainly not an archaeologist or an anthropologist, and I'm sure many of my listeners aren't either. So can you tell us more about what Paleo-Indians, that phrase you used?
Yes. Paleo-Indian is kind of unfortunately, it's a bit of a catch-all phrase, and it can mean different things depending on where you are. The area sort of the upper Great Lakes, the Huron area, Paleo-Indian peoples would have been more than likely people primarily hunting big game like caribou, but they also would have been exploiting other resources, wetlands. Work that I've done in other areas of Ontario have shown that these groups of people were using wetland resources, and they would have been the first group of people who came to the Great Lakes after the ice sheets left about 10 or 11,000 years ago. So they would have probably come from the south, they would have followed the ice sheets, and they would have settled in and around the Great Lakes. So Paleo-Indians are very earliest inhabitants of Ontario, and they were probably in and around, 10 to 8,000 years ago. After that, we have this sort of large time period that we all sort of lump as the Archaic. And really, we don't actually know a lot about this group of people. And in fact, there are probably several groups of people that sort of get lumped together. But really, we start seeing a shift in the type of resources that they're exploiting. They become more generalist. They're not as reliant on large game. They're using smaller game. Their tools are much more diverse. The Paleo-Indians are known for these very large, very, actually quite lovely spear points, whereas when we start getting into the archaic, we see things that are much more general. We start seeing things like awls and little knives and microblades and things like that. So that's really the difference between these two people. However, depending on where you are, that definition can change. So what one of the things we're hoping for while we're doing this type of research is that we learn more about these people so we can actually get a much better idea of who they were, what they were doing, and, you know, the differences in how they lived. Because right now we kind of lump them all together, and chances are they probably weren't this kind of uniform group of people. They were probably had all sorts of different things that they were doing. So we're kind of hoping that the work we do is going to help shed some light on that time period.
That was McMaster University researcher Lisa Sonnenberg. The review into Enbridge's proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline is underway. The Haisla have already told the three-member panel an oil spill would devastate their way of life. The chiefs also said they were facing a double-barreled threat because they could be facing a spill on the ocean and a spill on the Kitimat River, which empties into the Douglas Channel just north of their village. First Nation opposition to the proposed $5.5 billion project has been ongoing for more than 7 years. And 2 years ago, a group of coastal First Nation delegates visited the Gulf of Mexico to witness the damage done by the BP oil spill. Gerald Amos, an executive member of the group, said seeing the effects of that oil spill justified their opposition to Enbridge's proposed pipelines.
I recently returned last evening from New Orleans, where we were based. It's kind of central to the areas that we needed to go and touch base with a few folks, such as the president of the Shrimp Trawler Association in Louisiana and the Houma First Nation amongst them. What we did see pretty much confirmed the decision that we as coastal First Nations took to an issue a ban on very large crude carriers coming onto our waters.
Now, is this something you've been trying to stop for a long time?
We've been concerned about it for a number of years. Going back about 5 years or so, the company was threatening to file their proposal with the National Energy Board. But that didn't happen, mainly because I think the Carrier Second Nature Council out of Prince George filed a legal challenge that the company wasn't really prepared for, I think. And so they kind of put it on hold until quite recently when they filed with the National Energy Board. And we've been concerned. In fact, it goes back earlier in 1972, there was another proposal, not the current one, but another proposal to boil tankers into our area here. So going back 30-plus years, we've been aware that this was a target area for some of these companies who wanted to carry crude oil and pipeline.
And so with your work, what have you been doing, like petitioning the government to not allow that or telling Enbridge no?
Well, like I said, the Coastal First Nations, which is based out of Vancouver, but we're really on the central coast on the coast of British Columbia here. And we have 9-member communities. And it's unanimous amongst our organization, all the communities, that we, like I said, we issued a ban of our own and are telling government and industry that we won't allow super tanks carrying crude oil onto our coast and on our coastline. Because one of the things that we're now aware of, because of the British Petroleum things that are happening, unfolding in the Gulf right now, is that one super tanker, one of these very large crude carriers, based on the federal government in the United States estimates of what's leaked to date in that spill, one of these crude carriers carries as much as what's leaked to date down in the Gulf of Mexico. And they propose to bring 225 onto our waters per year.
Wow. Has the federal government responded to your ban?
Well, one of the things, just backtracking, I mentioned the timeline, 5 years. Our community particularly, but I know others have done the same, has been writing letters to the federal government, the National Energy Board, attempting to influence the development of the joint review process. We wanted to, going back, we're attempting to work with government to ensure that that the joint review process that is currently underway address the legal requirements that they're laid out by the courts with respect to the accommodation and consultation process that's required of them. And we didn't get anywhere on that front. Our attempts to work with government were rebuffed, and you know they're going onward and upward in their mind. I mean, they feel like, and the industry feels that the joint review process is going to actually address the concerns that the Chais and Kimat here, amongst other communities, will bring forward. But we feel that it's still lacking with respect to addressing the legal requirements that have been put forward by the courts. I mean, they don't even come. They don't come close to, in our view, to being adequate in respect of their legal requirements.
So, what are the next steps?
Our community and the Coastal First Nations have, in April of this year, I believe, or March of this year, had a press conference in Vancouver and announced that we were issuing a BAB. And what our community is saying in letters to that we will use any legal and other issues to address this. We'll do whatever it takes to ensure that this ban is upheld.
Okay, and is there anything else you'd like to say or add, Gerald?
Well, I think that, like you say, we just got back, as you noted, we just got back from a trip to Louisiana, and we were in Mississippi, we were in Florida, and on the Pensacola Beach, we were out at the Barrier Islands, Grand Island, all of those places normally in the July weekend were teeming with people, and the way they put it to us, well, they couldn't find a spot to lay down on the beach. It would be so busy. Nobody on the beaches. All the beaches are closed. The Shrimp Trees Association president is very concerned with respect to their culture, never mind the ecology culture. And this is a Cajun culture that relies on the shrimp at this point in time, just like we on the coast here rely on salmon. The shrimp is iconic to them as the salmon is to us. And everybody we talk to that's been impacted has given one message for us to bring home, and that's if you can at all help it, don't allow big oil to bring crude oil into your territory. If you do, it's pretty much over, because it's just a matter of time. It's not a question of if there's going to be a spill, it's just when it's going to happen. It's the message we've brought home, and we're going to do our utmost to ensure that our people hear the voices coming out of the Gulf of Mexico.
That was Gerald Amos, an executive member of Coastal First Nations. Now here's a song by 10-year-old Takaya Blaney. She's also voiced her opposition to the proposed pipeline, and I think she summed everything up best in her song, Shallow Waters. Have a listen, and then we'll hear from the young lady herself.
Shallow waters, I can't see. Your clear waves lapping at my feet. Lifeless ocean, black, not blue. I didn't help but deep down I knew. In shallow waters I used to see dolphins playing in front of me. The seaweed swaying, keeping time. Tidal rhythms, laugh not cry. Yeah. yet no waters I can't see. Your clear waves lapping at my feet.
Takaya Blaney is now 11 years old, and she's been speaking out about the Northern Gateway Pipeline for more than a year. Bomsida caught up with her last summer after she tried to see Enbridge Company executives at their head office in Vancouver.
Well, shallow waters is about a future wherein oil spill happens, and I wrote it because they have a Northern Gateway Pipeline, and it's proposed to go from the Tar Sands of Alberta to Kitimat, B.C., and this is super dangerous for a coast, for the ecosystem, for the First Nations culture, and I tried to bring this song to Enbridge, except they wouldn't let me through the front lobby, but because of this proposal, it's putting everything at risk. And we've had this culture for thousands of years, and they're just trying to put it at risk for an oil pipeline, which is really ridiculous. So
besides bringing your song Shallow Waters to Enbridge last month, what else did you want to tell them?
Well, I wanted to tell them that they should stop building all these pipelines and things like that, because this is our environment, it's our earth, and it's not like we have like a second one. We're living on it, and you can't keep trashing it, and you can't keep polluting it, and you can't keep putting these oil pipelines and putting all these people and these animals and these ecosystems at risk, because people's lives are putting at risk just for the sake of money. And
Takaya, why do you think they didn't let you in?
I didn't think I was scary or anything like that, but I had Greenpeace with me in the media, and then later on we found out that they're not allowed to bring cameras in there. But I just wanted to talk to them and tell them the message. But you see, companies like this, they're not open to hearing messages that people have to say.
Especially young women. And how did you feel when they wouldn't let you in or anything or respond?
I was super disappointed because I'd been waiting for that for a really long time. But the DNA from Alliances, they, in May, they flew me up to Calgary to speak at the Enbridge AGM, so that was really amazing. And they are just really generous, they're really inspirational. And so I got to speak at the Enbridge AGM, so it's really cool. So,
So how did you get into speaking out about the pipeline?
I'm homeschooled, and I've been studying about otters, and I just love the environment. I love observing it, and we live on a mountain, so we get to go on a lot of walks and things like that a lot. And then this newspaper article came out about the Northern Gateway Pipeline, and I wanted to do something about it, and I had an idea of making a song about it, so now we have Shallow Waters, and I entered Shallow Waters later on into David Suzuki's songwriting contest, and that really urged me on to do more things. And so now I'm singing Fort St. James and Bella Bella, and I'm spreading the word at the pipeline, and yeah, it's just pretty amazing.
It is most amazing. And do you think that you're going to continue on this path?
I think so, and I'm pretty sure. And there's also this other proposal to have a pipeline that goes to Dallas, Texas. So that's equally dangerous. Mm-hmm. So it's just companies that don't understand what they're putting at risk here. And they just don't understand at all.
Do you have a message for people out there, Takaya?
You have a voice. Let it be heard. You have a gift. Share it.
That was 11-year-old Takaya Blaney from the Sliaman Nation. You've been listening to Bomsida with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bomsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bomsida.